Rich Fiore and John Akers, thanks for joining us on the Global Gaming Business Podcast. It's great to talk to you guys. You've got such an exciting company going on here. Give us a background of the company and how it got started.
Well, I suppose this company got started with conversations with Bob Luciano.
Uh-huh.
I was doing some work with Bob, and he kept talking about Rich and some of the ideas that they'd had when they were at Sierra Design Group. And finally I said, geez, let's go meet Rich.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did, and you know, had a lot of respect for Rich right off from looking at his creative abilities.
Mm-hmm.
and the art and everything. So Rich and I just started talking a lot, and I think we spent about a year getting to know each other before
mm-hmm.
we just decided that it would make sense to you know, to take the talents that each of us have and
mm-hmm.
try to combine them. You know, Rich has this creative artistic side,
mm-hmm.
and I've got this other side that probably isn't worth as much as Rich's, but you know, we cover intellectual property and relationships and ideas, and then Rich brings those ideas into reality.
Okay.
So,
well, you were both coming out of sales of your previous companies, SDG to Bally's, correct?
And, correct.
And John, your company to IGT. Rich, what did that bring to you then in terms of why you wanted to get together with John?
Well, we were in an exciting time at RFA where we were tasked with starting a third-party development
mm-hmm.
group. We were in our second year, having just created our 11th game. We were just getting games out on the field on the Bally's Alpha platform, and we were very excited. Everyone had put a lot of time and effort into it. And frankly, we were kind of looking forward to the next couple years of getting the royalties of those games and continually developing games for Bally's and possibly others. However, John walked in the door, and it wasn't but several hours later that I realized that whenever I said a word, John would say a sentence, and then through that sentence I would say a paragraph. Next thing you know, it was us on the whiteboard coming up with an idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that a relationship quickly formed after that, and we realized, wait a second, we have a lot more to achieve and develop in the gaming industry.
Okay. John, you've been a major driver in the slot business for many years, you know, virtually inventing player tracking, progressives, bonusing, the bonus wheel, and other aspects that are now commonplace, now accepted by everybody. And everybody, we can't imagine what it would be like without them. Are we on the verge of another profound change in the slot business at this point?
Absolutely.
And what is that change?
Well, we've always had the luxury of underserving the customer so
mm-hmm.
far. We've had huge pent-up demand because there's a human urge to gamble. When it was illegal, there were very few venues.
Mm-hmm.
When I started, Nevada was the only place in the country that you could legally gamble. And when my parents would come out, they would give my father, here's $20, play the slot machines
right.
for me, let me know how I did. And nobody does that anymore because there's venues everywhere. Well, as that happens, as the quantity and of casinos and gaming machines and gaming opportunities has grown, the population base that is interested in gambling has not.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are going to have to start earning our keep just like any other consumer product does. We have to find new ways to communicate with players. And I don't see that as a bad news situation. I think that we have incredible opportunities with the technologies available to us today, the psychological studies we have available to us,
mm-hmm.
to create a brand new entertainment form mm-hmm. that will outstrip anything ever done.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of time frame do you see this before it really starts to take over?
Well, when I did, you know, to go through some examples, when I did player tracking, and we did the first one at Harrah's in 1983. It was Harrah's Marino on like 60 machines. It took literally until the early 90s, about 10 years,
mm-hmm.
for player tracking to be widely accepted. When we did bonuses at Acres Gaming, we started that in about 94,
mm-hmm.
and it was probably about 8 years before that was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Even low-hanging fruit like bill validators, where everyone can see instantly
right.
the benefits of it, it took 4 or 5 years. So I would guess we're in the 5 to 10 year frame
mm-hmm.
before this new version is fully realized.
Okay. And how is this going to come about? Is this a part of the server-based gaming phenomena that we've been talking about?
Well, I think that the problem with the server-based gaming phenomenon is it's really a phenomenon, not a product.
Mm-hmm.
It's a set of words that conjure up a set of meanings that differ according to the listener and according to what the listener wants to hear. I think that a lot of server-based gets its magic because there was bill validators and a replacement cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And IGT made a lot of money.
Right.
There was Tito and a replacement cycle. And IGT made a lot of money.
Right.
Now the analysts are saying server-based. Replacement cycle.
Right.
IGT is going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is that that's not necessarily so.
Mm-hmm.
IGT is creating this huge network that has a lot of sensibilities in it, but it's not done yet.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, what they're going to have is a set of plumbing with nothing to run through it.
Right.
So we don't have a fully featured articulation of a product yet. And over here, maybe it has been less well articulated as far as capturing the imagination of analysts, but Bally's working on something very similar, in the way the similarity being wide pipes in which to pass lots of information, because that's always the problem we've got.
Sure.
When I did the first player tracking system, our bandwidth was 10,000 bits per second.
Mm-hmm.
Now the new systems, we're looking at 1 billion bits per second.
Mm.
So, you know, there's just huge, huge increases in capacity to run things.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to learn how to do promotions that use that capacity
that
still, or better yet, start to please the player that's sitting at the other end.
Right. So is this a good time to be in the slot content business?
Well, for us, it is.
Mm-hmm.
First off, we both proved our merit for many, many years in this industry, specifically John, based on player tracking and bonusing and mysteries. So right now, we're small, but with the respect of many manufacturers and with many casino operators that are turning to groups like ours with very optimistic ideas, but really have no way to implement them.
Right.
And so we find ourselves in a very a good situation where not only we are working on other ideas, but we're working on our own.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you work with both operators and manufacturers, correct?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. We do. We must. Because ultimately, we want to reach the customer.
Mm-hmm.
The problem in reaching the customer is we don't have a casino.
Right.
We don't deserve to have a casino. We wouldn't know how to run one. That's a huge amount of business.
Mm-hmm.
But even once we get the operator partner, now we're stuck with the old model, which is, oh, let's design a cabinet, let's design the electronics that go inside of a game, etc. Well, other manufacturers have already done that very, very well.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do, and what we are doing, is partnering with manufacturers to say, we'll take your base game and all of the bill validator technology and everything else that works, and we'll put on top of that this new player appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And together, we'll make a stronger package.
Okay.
And that gets delivered through that operator. So more than ever, we have a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a supply chain, if you will, where it starts with the player coming into the gaming venue, which supplies games and content, which consists of ideas that we or others create that gets put on top of a hardware platform.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets all tied together by somebody's system.
Right. Am I correct in assuming that you guys don't want to be a slot manufacturer?
We do not.
You know, one of the weakness for me at ADT, Micon, and Acres Gaming was manufacturing, because it takes a mindset, and we work on the theory that creativity is inversely proportional to the size of the organization, because the larger the organization gets, the more rules you need to keep it marching in the same direction. Well, if we do manufacturing, we're by definition large. We have large capital commitments, we have inventory management issues, we have all sorts of problems, and that's going to suck away the creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Where if we make ourselves a creative organization that partners kind of at arm's length with a manufacturer like Bally,
right,
then we think we get the best of everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So partnerships are your business model then, for the most part?
Absolutely.
Yeah. The first game that we've seen your company release is Halo, being released on the Bally's operating system and in their cabinets. Describe why you picked Bally's hardware. Did you anticipate partnering with them at the time you were developing that?
I think that, first off, Bally's has the ultimate platform for which to develop games on. The Alpha platform is very helpful when developing games, not only through animations, but the software available for sound and getting the game through a process of getting it through GLI and actually into a property.
Right.
We look at many games, and frankly, right now, if you look at the Bally's games in particular, specifically the Video First, Cinevision, now Cinereals, and the S9 product, they're excellent.
Right.
Not only on their development platforms, but also in the way that the games play, and we just looked at them as a very good partner for our first game. Halo is now in two properties in California, doing very well. We're very excited about it. It was a process that from day one, we took about 8 months to actually get it through GLI and installed. And this was one more reason why we realized quite quickly that we certainly don't want to be a distributor.
Right.
What we want to be is creative and developing the games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the other reason we ended up with Bally is certainly Bob Lucian, who sold SDG to Bally, became an important driver of Bally. He very early on saw the need for partnerships, and he pushed Bally to develop a developer's kit. It's one thing to say, here's our game, go design something for it, but if you don't have the tools to write for it, then it's very difficult.
Right.
And Bally is absolutely a generation ahead of everybody else in having that development kit. And so the relationship with Bob, the enthusiasm on the part of guys like Dick Hadrill and Gavin Isaacs, and the developer kit were plenty of reasons to go with Bally.
Tell me why you think this kind of industry has grown here, this slot content industry, and hasn't really burgeoned out of the companies themselves.
For the same reason that book publishers don't write bestsellers. You get a person inside of that structure, and the creativity just doesn't happen. If it was as easy to write a game, let's use that book analogy.
Yeah.
If all I had to do is hire an English major who knows how to construct a sentence and say, write me a bestseller, well, there wouldn't be these independent authors.
Right.
But it ain't that easy.
Yeah.
it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. And that takes, because we're reaching out to touch an individual, that takes an individual or a very small team of individuals to create that emotional connection. A large organization tends to get stuck in rules and regulations and this one worked before, let's color it green and maybe it worked again. And sometimes that's okay for a little while, but it gets to be very non-creative.
Okay. And keep in mind, there are manufacturers that have great successes. We have a great amount of admiration for all the big manufacturers, Bally's, IGT, Konami's, Williams, etc. We just are able to make changes quicker.
Right.
In our game Halo, we would not take a week to make a change. We would make it in an hour.
Yeah.
Our wind proximity indicator has changed at least 20 times in the process of a month to make it right. So those were decisions we were to make in-house, not by a committee, but by several individuals.
So this is almost like comparing the Harrah's organization with the Silverton, for instance, a small casino that can change their marketing direction in an instant, whereas a large company is going to have to move the big ship.
There's certainly an analogy there, but I think that the difference between in that analogy is that Silverton is still in the casino business. We are not trying to be in the manufacturing business whatsoever. We don't even want to be a small manufacturer.
Right.
We're saying we want to stay away from all that stuff
and
focus purely on the creative content.
Describe how your innovation, the player tracking, bonusing, have evolved and how you see them fitting into the network floor in the future.
Well, if we start with player tracking, it was the first attempt to personalize the experience, to say, this is your bonus, this is what you get. And we've never, because of the limitations of technology, taken that as far as we can go. But ultimately, a great casino experience is not about giving the player endless choices. It's about giving them recommendations, about setting the table for them. Imagine you walk into a restaurant and they hand you a menu with 100 pages. Well, after a while, you get pretty frustrated by that. Now, imagine you walk into another restaurant and they say, Roger, it's good to see you again. May I suggest the veal tonight? Because
right.
it's especially good, and he knows that that's the dish you're particularly interested
right.
in. We have the opportunity to take the loyalty system and turn it into a suggestion mm-hmm. system so that players don't have to go out and seek a game, but when they sit down and they identify themselves to the game seeks them.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I first used a player tracking system, put the card in, and it, you know, the little thing comes mm-hmm. up, hello, Roger, you know, still, it was somewhat impersonal. Are you developing systems that
are... Said Roger.
Well, exactly. We knew it was a machine that was telling you that. Are you developing systems that will allow casinos to provide, you know, better personal customer service to their players?
Well, we think so, but the problem is this, that personal is personal. And there's no easy way, no way that at all that I know of, to take a machine and cause it to deliver that same emotional gratification. And if we simply try to imitate it, if we simply put a video image of a person sitting in the back room talking to you, that's kind of like talking to an operator somewhere that doesn't even know what state mm-hmm. you're living in,
right.
because the impersonality of it becomes all the more heightened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what we try to do more is get out of the player's way, to make this thing become what they're looking for without them even knowing what they're looking for, as opposed to mimicking communication. Because I think a great opportunity in the hosting business in the future is, even though we've taken off the change people from the floor, is to put more people back on the floor in the hosting function.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because the person-to-person communication, you know, for the same reason that we're sitting here today talking into microphones instead of talking over telephones, mm-hmm. is it just works better.
Right.
And I don't think that we want to try to emulate something that we know we cannot reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
We want to augment that.
Right. I remember seeing the Mariposa software for the first time and recognizing how powerful that could be
mm-hmm.
When the host sees somebody on the floor, they can go right to them, they understand who they are, what they're playing, and what their wants and desires are. So is that something you see even extending further with some of the things you're developing?
Oh, absolutely. What we look at is a player walks into the casino and they have a certain budget.
Mm-hmm.
And the casino has a set of expenses that can be pretty daunting,
sure.
especially when they're in the high tax rate states. So you have to somehow provide the service at a cost that still allows you to take a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you walk into the casino with $10 million in your pocket. Well, certainly I can personally
right.
greet you there.
Yes.
That's easy. But let's say you walk into the casino with $100 in your mm-hmm. pocket. Well, I've got to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to send someone to see you, but the best personal experience I can give you is probably drink delivery, and can I help you with anything, and making sure that things are supporting you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people intrinsically understand that. So we want to provide great service in an automated way so that it's cheaper for the casino to provide and more satisfying for the player.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen players that hate to sit there and wait for hand pay jackpots, for
right.
example,
mm-hmm.
and Tito got rid of a lot of that.
Right.
Well, that's an example of, even though the hand pay jackpot was a personal service, because on a Friday night it would take so long
mm-hmm.
to wait, you would prefer the automated service now
right.
to the personal service mm-hmm. an hour from now.
Right. But the personal service can come when you come get to the cage, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and we think that as we automate more of these functions, we can relieve the people of their drudgery of their normal work
mm-hmm.
and make them more available for the hosting function.
Mm-hmm.
More of the hi, how are you today, right. than here's your change for a 50, goodbye.
Right.
Looking for the most informative weekly publication in the gaming industry? Subscribe to Global Gaming Business Weekly, the only electronic news magazine that brings the news of the gaming industry to your desktop every Monday morning. Global Gaming Business Weekly is a complete publication with information on the gaming industry in the U.S., Europe, Asia, and beyond. Read about the latest moves in Indian gaming, the updated research about problem gaming, the breaking news that will impact everyone in the gaming industry all in one publication. Global Gaming Business Weekly is read by all the top executives in the gaming industry before they start their work week. Shouldn't you? To subscribe, go to the Global Gaming Business website, www.ggbmagazine.com, click on the Global Gaming Business Weekly icon. Don't be the last to know. Read Global Gaming Business Weekly every Monday morning.
another thing that server-based gaming brings is the ability to personalize the offering to the player. And certainly, when you can recognize the player, recognize the games that they like, and you can suggest some alternate games that are similar to that. Is that the direction we're going in?
Well, I think that's the direction we're going in. I think that we have to get some nomenclature clear here. If we're talking about server-based gaming as IGT defines it, I don't think that's a part of that product. Mm-hmm. We're interested not in server-based gaming because we think that's a symptom of what's wrong mm-hmm. with the industry, that we're talking about technology. Mm-hmm. We talk about bill validators. We talk about Tito. We talk about server-based gaming. We want to present the challenge of player-based gaming, mm-hmm. that it doesn't matter what the technology is. It matters what the player experience mm-hmm. is.
Okay. What do you think of the server windows that are service windows that are you know now being produced by the two big companies and you know they seem to be enamored with that, and I personally think it might distract the player a little more than they need to be. Is there something that you're developing that either replaces that or augments that?
Well, the benefit of the service window, or let's abstract it from one manufacturer another's terms for it, of a window that can be positioned on the game screen.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit of that is it's a strong communication channel with the player.
Mm-hmm.
When we started doing player tracking and we had the really little tiny displays up next to a card reader,
right,
and we wanted to say, "Hi, Roger, welcome to our casino." Well, you might see that, but let's say you're playing and I want to say, "Hey, Roger, here's a bonus."
Yeah.
Well, half the time you didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we ran into at Acres Gaming. So we started doing the larger displays, and we did that big LCD display that IGT now calls, well, we called it Next Gen, mm-hmm. and IGT has that now.
Right.
Bally calls theirs iView, but it's the same thing.
Right.
A bigger display, but still it's out of the line of normal vision because the player is having this intimate relationship with the game. And moving that communication channel down onto the game is more powerful in that it reaches the player. But as you said, it also starts to compete for that space mm-hmm. with the game itself.
Right.
And so the art of the service window isn't in overlaying a communication box on top of a game. It's in how you use it and when you use it. And that's what we think we can help with.
Mm-hmm.
We think that Bally and IGT and these guys are really good at placing these boxes there, but they only think of them as boxes and fill it in with whatever you want. Well, maybe it's not a box. Maybe it's a little pop-up icon over mm-hmm. here. Maybe it's this or that. But it's got to be some way to communicate important things to the player to enhance their emotional experience at the machine without disrupting the base game emotional appeal.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that paradigms still exist that will tie the casinos to the old way of doing business on the slot floor? In other words, buying standalone boxes from traditional slot manufacturers?
Yeah, they're called slot managers.
Yeah.
you know, there is an old paradigm of doing things mm-hmm. in a certain way, and all of us will have to adapt. We have to realize that content isn't just what's in the game. It's what's on the system.
Mm-hmm.
It's how the floor is laid out, how it's percentaged, how the signage is done. All of that becomes the holistic content that the player experiences. And we're going to have an entirely new generation of thinking to reach out to that next level because, mm-hmm. we've burned up this pent-up demand.
Right.
We got to reach out to the 60% of the population mm-hmm. that does not gamble at all and give them a more entertaining experience.
Mm-hmm. Do people really understand bonusing yet? I mean, I know I've been through, this, when it was introduced at Mandalay Bay, there was a lot of confusion about, who was bonused. I know you had the wide area bonusing systems there, and I think a lot of people were confused. Is that something that you have rectified to a certain extent?
To an extent, I think that some of it is... it's just a matter of time. You got to give people a chance to get used to it, and they have to have the context to think of it in. Some of it is having bigger and better channels of communication with the player. But ultimately, you hit it right on the head. It's here's this great thing, but if I can't make you understand what that great thing is, it's not a great thing anymore.
Right.
It's a cost without benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly at Mandalay Bay, we ran into huge challenges, not the least of which was caused by a change in Mandalay Bay management mm-hmm. right before they opened, and the whole philosophy of what we want to do got changed. So we had a big problem at the start that was made considerably worse by a change in philosophy mm-hmm. right at the end. So all of a sudden, these promotions got twisted 90 degrees, and it was not effective.
Right.
But you take those same bonuses
mm-hmm.
and you put them in stations
right.
where the management took away half of them, maybe mm-hmm. two-thirds of them, and says, here's what we're going to introduce, and they do a lot of marketing behind it. And I think that that clearly bonuses made stations mm-hmm. what they, let me rephrase that. Stations used the tool of bonusing to become what they are today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Another intriguing type of development that's begun in the slot area is the guaranteed play system that IGT is trying to install. You know, they've done some tests on it in limited ways, but it's not been rolled out in the full-blown program that they had hoped that it would be, you know, or that they say it will be eventually. Do you think this is an interesting way to go at this point?
I think that Jay Walker is pushing the envelope, mm-hmm. and I think he has a very creative mind. As it was, obviously, it did not do well at stations, mm-hmm. but does not mean that it might not have a place in the future. We're certainly looking at a lot of different ways of reaching the players mm-hmm. in the future. This just wasn't the right time, and you know, usually when you do a test, you don't put an amount on that many games.
Right.
But the fact is, and I'm sure they'll come out with a better product. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, but going back to your last point about confusion. Mm-hmm. If you look at a casino floor now, besides bonusing, how many players are actually confused about every single penny and nickel game they're playing right now?
Right.
No one understands what a scatter pace is.
No
one
sure.
goes to the video screen to see how on earth did I just win.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to make, we're going in that full circle of simplicity, trying to understand how do you get quarters back on the floor, how to get dollars back on the floor. Let someone actually understand the game, mm-hmm. and maybe they'll stay on the floor for more than 6 months.
Sure.
And the same thing has to hold true when it comes to the way that we go after this player-based gaming, with simplicity and make them understand what just has taken place.
Mm-hmm.
So they appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, I can tell you from personal experience that's true. My mother loves to play the slots that used to have the old lines,
mm-hmm.
so you knew when things
yeah.
lined up and
sure.
how many. And she, you know, she plays these games now, the five real nine line games, and she said, I don't know how I won, but I won.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's not as satisfying for them, I don't
mm-hmm.
think. Is that something that you found?
It's not satisfying. It's frustrating,
mm-hmm.
and that's why manufacturers had this replacement cycle. Has taken place.
Mm-hmm.
A game used to stay on the floor for years.
Right.
Now it stays on for months.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as bad as what's happening to the movie industry. When you look at a movie would stay out for a while. And then all of a sudden it goes to a DVD almost as quick as it went to the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do better games. We need to listen to our public. We need to make it interesting and fun and entertaining. And that's what we're doing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But to elaborate on that point, there are clearly players that are entertained by
mm-hmm.
those multi-line games.
Right.
And what we're seeing as we want to broaden our appeal to the population base, we can't think of the player wants. We have to think of this segment of players want.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there's a place for the complex games. There's a place for the strategy games. There's a place for the skill games.
Mm-hmm.
There's a place for the I want to put in my coin and see if I'm lucky
mm-hmm.
games.
Right.
And we can't confuse and say there's a right or a wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We have to specialize. And again, that's where this player-based gaming comes from, because we don't want to force this player to go out and seek the game. We want to say, oh, it's Roger. Roger likes these kind of
mm-hmm.
games. Here. So that your mother, for example, would find herself automatically linked to a more satisfying game
mm-hmm.
for her personality and her desires on that time.
I see. Where do you think progressives are going? I was in a casino the other night and noticed the megabucks was up to 18 million. And I remember, you know, just a few years ago when it hit over 12 million, people would be lined up to playing it. And that's
mm-hmm.
not the case anymore. Is that lost its allure to a certain extent?
Well, when you say progressive, are you talking about the change of life amount of money?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The multi casino
yeah.
linked slots.
Lotteries have killed. Or not killed, but certainly maimed
yeah.
the change your life amount of money that
mm-hmm.
casinos can accumulate. There's no what did the lottery winner win a couple weeks ago?
200 million.
Yeah, 200 some
yeah.
million. We can't formulate a jackpot
right.
like that.
Yeah.
When I started EDT, and we were doing progressives at first, the largest progressive jackpot in the city was at the Flamingo Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the Flamingo Hilton,
right.
And it was pegged at $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
and that would be given away about once a year. In fact, what really got us going at EDT on Progressives is we did some for Steve Wynn in Atlantic City.
Right.
And it was me, myself, and I at EDT then, so I went out and installed them.
Right.
And Steve came down, and I said, okay, where do you want to start these things at? And I figured, you know, $10,000, $20,000. We had like five of them. He says, well, start this one at $250,000, this one at $500,000, this one at $800,000, and start this one at $1,000,000. And I said, you mean stop it there?
Yeah.
And he says, no, start it there. And I said, but what if it hits? And this is when I started really learning about the magic of the gaming appeal. He says, exactly. If it hits, everybody's going to be here.
Well, I was working at the Golden Nugget at the time, and I remember when the guy hit the first million-dollar jackpot, and it was sensational.
It was on the CBS News.
It was
that little black and white clip, and oh my gosh, somebody won $1,000,000.
Yeah.
Well, now if somebody wins $1,000,000, they go, won $1,000,000. Good for them. You know,
it
because the lotteries have changed our scale, and if we go as soon as somebody hit $1,000,000. $1,000,000 isn't news. Now we got to have 1.5 or 2 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And even on the lotteries now, if somebody wins $100,000,000, somebody won $100,000,000.
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing that it goes down that direction. Let's talk about the Gaming Standards Association. You know, you recognized very early on that there needed to be some coordination in the technology between all the companies. Do you feel that your vision in founding the GSA now is being fully realized and now that we're moving towards server-based gaming?
Well, you know, once again, I think that it, help me out, when you say server-based gaming, do you mean IGT's version or just
enhanced
network?
It's hard to put your arms around that.
Yeah, we're moving towards a more advanced network that requires more enhanced communications. And what we used to have, what always frustrated me, was this Tower of Babel we had on the casino floor where every game spoke a different language, and none of them spoke a rich enough language to have a good conversation with them about.
Right.
And so we had these things called bonus commands that we wanted to send to the machine, and we had to go to each manufacturer, and they thought, oh, well, we'll do the protocol in a proprietary way. And what got GSA going, which originally was called Gamma, was I bought a new computer, and I was plugging in my printer.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I have I think it was an HP computer, and I had an Epson printer, and they plugged together. And I knew that HP sold more computers and Epson sold more printers because of that than if you had to buy the HP printer and all this other stuff. And it was like, why do we have this and here in the computer industry and over here in the slot industry, we have all this proprietariness? So I started doing some research on how they got here and found out they did standards committees. And so went to, I just sent letters to everybody I could think of, including operators, because they're the only ones who could force it.
Right.
And said, wouldn't life be better if we all agreed to these basic things? And it took a long time to come to that. But I think it's well on its way. I think that the thing that I'm not sure that GSA has caught up with yet, I think they've got a great initial standard, but to how dynamic that standard needs to remain. It's not enough to have version 1. We got to be version 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, because we have to keep extending this thing.
Right.
And I liken it to USB, where there was USB 1.0, USB 2.0, now we're looking on version 3, and there's USB wireless and all this other stuff. We're going to have to do that same thing with standards. So I think that GSA has done Peter DeRiet has done an incredible job over there of getting us started.
Yeah.
And by gosh, you can't criticize somebody for getting things started.
Right.
That said, they're going to have to grow more.
Yeah. Well, I noticed they're retiring the SAS standards already. That just seemed like it came out just a couple of years ago, which I'm sure it did.
But it was really kind of the SAS standard was kind of a political compromise to make certain companies with three initials in their name happy. So, we needed a better standard, and I think that everybody agrees with that now.
Okay. Where do you see your company going in the next 4 or 5 years? What would you like to see it become?
Well, I think we're becoming it. Right now, we're continually developing better relationships with the operators, which is number one for us. We're ahead of schedule. I think we're leading the way right now as a third-party developer. If I'm not mistaken, John, we're the only third-party developer that actually has our own game out through GLI with really great numbers, which we're very excited about. We have a great partnership with manufacturers, specifically Bally's, and you know we're looking to continually, you know, we've all done well, but we want to go do something that really changes the direction of gaming. And I think that this player-based gaming is certainly very high on our priority, along with developing new games. We're developing a new progressive bank that I think will change the way people look at mysteries, which will probably be done, and I would say, and out in the market, 6 to 8 months, I would say, or less. So, John?
Well, what I thought of was when Rich and I started talking about doing a business, we said, what do we want to accomplish? What's the purpose of this? And what we came up with was we would like to change the industry, have a significant impact. We would like to have a good time doing it. We'd like to make some money. And so I think that we're well on track to all of those things. If we can create a new paradigm for the industry or help create that, because again, it's a partnership thing. It's not just us saying, oh, we're going to do everything. It's us providing a link in that chain of success. If we can do that, we're going to have fun and we're going to make money.
Right. So, where do you see the slot business itself going in the next 10 years? You know, right now we've got the big six manufacturers. Do you see them consolidating or even going off in different directions?
I think it's going to be tough to see a lot of consolidation because the company that's best positioned to consolidate is limited by government from acquiring more. It's going to be very difficult for IGT to take over a WMS, for example.
Right.
And when you get down from IGT, which has, a 40% market share, 45% market share, the other manufacturers, like here's Bally, that's just gone through an incredible resurgence. You know,
right.
They were at death's door
two
or three years ago, and they're doing very well. And I think that they understandably are saying, for the next two or three years, we kind of have all we can handle right here. We don't need the complexities of bringing somebody else in. And I think that Aristocrat is going through its own metamorphosis over in Australia. So I don't see tight consolidations as far as acquisitions. What I see is consolidations of sharing of intellectual property. And we're already starting to see that. Here's Walker and IGT, and they license the IP. They don't buy the company. And I think that you'll see more and more sharing or partnerships in particular directions between two companies where they say, we've got this IP, you've got this IP. Tito was a great example of that. You know, Bally and IGT, and I think they acquired some MGM patents too, and put those all into a pool.
Right.
And I think you'll see a lot more consolidation along those lines than along the traditional, we're all one company, we all have one stock.
Right. How about internationally, Rich? Obviously, gaming is growing, you know, like leaps and bounds around the world. Is that going to affect the development of slot technology and slot content?
I think it already has. We've opened up an office in Macau. It's been open now for about 2 months. And our individual over there is really just on a task to try to get more information. We've already learned a great deal about how different they play the games than they do in North America.
Right.
I mean, it's frankly amazing.
Yeah.
The superstition, it's interesting because if you win a golf game here and someone says you're lucky, that's like, well, no, it's skill.
Yeah.
Over there, if they say you're lucky, that's like, that's right, I'm lucky, I'm special.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of differences. There's been many manufacturers that are over there right now that are developing games and modifying them slightly. We're going to modify them at a much greater detail. And once again, being smaller, we're going to have the opportunity of doing that. But in that entire area, gaming is going to grow. Macau, I think, is a small example of the growth.
Of course, we have Thailand and Singapore and Hong Kong. And as people have pointed out to me, they're all different cultures. It's not just one big Asian culture. You know, you have to know the differences in each culture. And I guess that's a part of the idea of having an Asian office for you guys.
We got to learn. We think that we can learn lessons from the Asian player and bring them back here, primarily because the Asian player doesn't have the stigma of, not shame, it's not that strong, but stigma of hesitation regarding gaming.
Right.
They embrace it there. It's oh, I'm going to go gambling.
Right.
Here you go, I'm going to go to the casino.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily declare it as openly.
There's still a lot of denial over there that slot machines are ever going to take off as well as they have here. Do you think that they will become as much of a part of the casino experience as they are in the U.S.?
I believe they will. You know, certainly we believe that 10 years from now the slot machine will be dominant in Macau. However, since it's only at 3 or 4% of revenue right now, even if we're wrong and slots only become 20% instead of 70%, it's still a huge market.
Yeah.
So the nice thing for us is we don't have to be dead on right in my own belief that it'll be the same ratio as here. But even if we're just a little bit right, there's a lot of money to be made there.
Well, John Akers and Rich Fiore, thanks for joining us on the Global Gaming Business Podcast. Very interesting stuff. You have affected the slot industry so much over the past 10 years, both of you, and we're looking forward to seeing what you'll do in the next 10.
Thanks.
Great.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you for choosing the Global Gaming Business Podcast. If you want to learn about any of the issues discussed on this show, go to our website at ggbmagazine.com or subscribe to the industry's most comprehensive newsletter, Global Gaming Business Weekly. We'll see you next week for another edition of the Global Gaming Business Podcast.